Hello, I'm Sonia Broomfield. This is number 0410, the Stuff File Program, with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File Program, number 0410. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File Program, we remember actor Stephen First, who recently passed away. He was best known as Flounder in Animal House. Back in 2002, he talked about his weight and his diabetes.
You know, it was kind of cool because I didn't like who I was as this fat kid, but when I was acting, I was playing somebody else, and that person was fat. I couldn't help it if that person was fat, and I was always under the impression that being fat helped my career, which it may have. But, and I use the excuse of, well, I can't lose weight because it'll ruin my career. I won't be able to get any movie roles anymore. I use that for many, many years to keep the weight on.
Jared Rabin, creator of Hang-O-Matic, which easily allows you to hang your wall decor. It's an invention that was many years in the making.
15 years, believe it or not. I spent several years prototyping it by hand and just being able to afford the patents and the engineering and getting manufacturing in line. But about 15 years total from the time I thought of it to the time I got it into the first retail location.
Stuart Nallman is in with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nallman, and Book Banter goes to the races with Steve McQueen, Le Mans in the rearview mirror. So gentlemen, start your engines and wait for the checkered flag. The race begins soon on the Stuff File Program.
And, of course, we have lots and lots of Stuff File news and an idiot of the day, the guest Slater. The person who told you this was show number 0410 was Sonia Broomfield, who does the on-air graphics for the morning show Breakfast Television at City TV right here in Montreal. Thank you very much, Sonia, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File Program, a show which, by the way, is also listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you, that's all of you out there, for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? According to police in Brooklyn, New York, officers responded to a 911 call of a man who was injured and bleeding heavily. Officers found 20-year-old Manos Economidis dead. He suffered 3 stab wounds in the chest and back. A resident in the building said that there was a lot of noise coming from one apartment throughout the night where Economidis allegedly had a consensual threesome with 21-year-old Jack Doherty and a 21-year-old woman. Now, according to witnesses, the woman became upset after realizing that Economidis had recorded the threesome. Doherty drove the woman back to her Staten Island home, while Economidis stayed in the apartment where the 3 people had sex. Meanwhile, the woman contacted her boyfriend, who was not involved in the threesome, and allegedly said that she had been raped by Economidis. The boyfriend and 2 other men went to the apartment and confronted Economidis. He was beaten and stabbed as he tried to run from the apartment. Surveillance cameras showed 2 white men and a black man running after Economidis with baseball bats. Economidis managed to go to a neighbor's house and ask for help before he collapsed and died. Well, that's the epitome of a sad, sordid tale, isn't it? And you know, this drama really isn't over. I mean, at some point, if not already, that boyfriend is going to realize that his girlfriend was in a consensual 3-way that didn't involve him. And on a personal note, call me old-fashioned, but I would never be in a 3-way. You want to know why? Well, since this is a family show, let me share an analogy that will help you understand. Have you ever been driving on the highway and the driver in front of you decides to use his windshield washer fluid to clean his windshield? And some of that washer fluid comes over the top of his car and hits your windshield? Yeah. I have my own fluid, thank you. I don't need someone else's fluid on my windshield. Have I made myself clear? Moving right along, a Rhode Island company that makes jewelry from breast milk. Let me pause here and let that statement sink in just a little. A Rhode Island company that makes jewelry from breast milk has been ordered to refund customers and return the breast milk they sent. WPRI-TV reports a state superior court judge this week approved a judgment and temporary restraining order against Mommy Milk Creations and owner Alicia Mogavero. State Attorney General Peter Kilmartin's office sued this year after receiving several complaints from customers who said that they'd sent the company bags of their breast milk but have been waiting as long as 2 years for it to send their promised creations back to them. The station says Mogavero must refund $15,000 to 114 customers from across the country and as far away as Singapore. The company promises on its website all remaining orders are being completed. Perhaps I'm being naive here, but if you sent in breast milk 2 years ago, would you really want it back? And finally, on this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first item here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a smoky fire in a restroom resulted in the evacuation of a Walgreens drugstore in Modesto, California. A man came out of the restroom, admitted to employees that he set the fire, and then left. Police caught up with him and got his story. 45-year-old Andrew Cheadle told police that he had an accident and ran to the restroom, but couldn't get his underwear off. His solution? He pulled out a lighter and set them on fire to burn them off. Amazingly, that worked, and then he had flaming underwear to dispose of, so he tossed them in the toilet. Not surprisingly, that worked, but there was also so much smoke that it triggered the store's evacuation. Sympathetic police didn't charge Cheadle with arson, but they did arrest him anyway. They found two warrants for him for unrelated felony charges. Are you like me, wondering just what kind of accident you have that would require burning off your underwear? The only thing I can think of is that Andrew really needs to change his diet. Anyway, let's get to our first interview guest on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Recently, we lost actor-director Stephen First. He passed away at the age of 63 at his California home back on June 16th. From complications with diabetes. He first came to our attention as an actor for his role as Flounder in the movie Animal House. As a doctor on the hit NBC medical drama Sin Elsewhere, which is my favorite show of all time, by the way, plus on the syndicated sci-fi classic Babylon 5. I had the chance to catch up with Stephen when he was promoting a book that he wrote that actually dealt with his diabetes and a large weight loss that he had accomplished at that time. The book was called Confessions of a Couch Potato, or If I'm So Skinny, Why Do I Still Feel Like Flounder? It was a conversation we had back in December of 2002. I started by telling him that Sin Elsewhere was indeed my favorite show. I said on this show many a time, that is my favorite television show of all time.
Oh, cool. Thank you so much. It's my favorite job I've ever done, too.
Really?
Yeah.
Now, you were on it in the beginning. You joined after, what, the first year?
Yeah, I came in on the second year.
Yeah. You have a book, as I mentioned, it's called Confessions of a Couch Potato, or If I'm So Skinny, Why Do I Still Feel Like Flounder? And, of course, Flounder is the character you played in the 1978 movie Animal House.
Right.
Which so many people know you for, of course. And you were heavy. You lost, what, 140 pounds?
Yeah, I was 320 pounds at my highest weight, and I currently weigh about 180. And I've been a diabetic since I was 17. I was diagnosed at 17 years old as being a diabetic, and that was the same exact year that my dad died of diabetes at the age of 47. And you'd think that that would have been enough to, like, scare me, But it didn't. I waited till I was 40 years old to, you know, have something happen to me and made me lose the weight.
Now, what happened that made you lose the weight?
Well, I cut my foot. It was exactly this time of year, Christmas time. And I cut my foot, and being a diabetic, it got infected. I got put in the hospital. They were talking about amputating my left foot. And they put me on a diabetic diet, and I was starving to death because it was a very strict diet, and I hated it. So I was desperate. I asked the nurse for some Yellow Pages, and I called for Chinese food to be delivered to my room while I was in the hospital. And I said to the guy, whatever you do, don't go to the nurse's station. Come right to my room because, you know, I didn't want to be, you know, caught. But English not being his primary language, he went to the nurse's station. And the nurse came into my room holding up the bag of Chinese food. Now, I got to tell you, this nurse looked like Lou Cabrazzi from The Godfather. She holds up the Chinese food. She says, Mr. First, is this your food? And, of course, I denied it. I was fearful of her. And about 10 minutes later, the custodian came in, removed the phone out of my room. And then about 30 minutes later, she came in to take my vital signs, and I smelled my Chinese food on her breath. She had eaten the Chinese food that I tried to smuggle in. And so I lost 12 pounds in the hospital, and I came out, and I said, God, I want to try for 15. I feel good. And then I said, I'm going to go for 20. And it just kind of snowballed. And I knew that I was never going to stay on a diet, any kind of traditional diet. So I made up my own diet, one that I could live with, and I lost all this weight, and that's what the book's about. I want to share the diet with people. And also, it's all these funny stories about growing up fat, being fat in show business, and how, you know, people looked at me and discriminated against me, and it's just funny things that happened, you know, during my life. So it's not a diet book, it's not a recipe book, and it's not a funny book, it's all of the above.
And it does have some recipes in it, as you say. Now,
yes.
You said you created this diet on your own. Was there a trial and error period? Did you have a time where you tried things that didn't work and you had to regroup, so to speak?
Well, there are some recipes that I tried that didn't work because my diet is I try to duplicate things that I really liked, like cheesecake, movie theater popcorn, you know, Thanksgiving dinner with all the trimmings, you know. And some things worked and some things didn't. So this is all the stuff that worked.
Now, you said you discovered or you were aware of the fact that you were diabetic at the age of 17.
Right.
Well, was the diabetes, in effect, one of the reasons for your weight, or were the two not related? Were you just somebody who liked to eat?
Well, no, the reason why I was fat was not because of diabetes. The reason why I got diabetes was because I was fat.
Okay.
You know, anybody who has it in their family and is overweight is very, very likely to get it. And you know, it's a hereditary disease, and if you're sedentary like I was, you know, I didn't move. You know, I just, you know, went from the kitchen table to sit down in front of the TV, still snacking.
And having lost your dad at such a young age,
mm-hmm.
and being overweight, the two, I mean, this is something I'm sure you were aware of at that time, were you not?
Oh, I was aware, but it just, you know, food was my best friend. It never let me down. It was something that I needed, you know, and still do to this day, actually.
How did you get into acting? Because here you are, you mentioned a few moments ago that you were obviously, like a lot of kids, teased because of your weight. And sometimes that's a situation where people don't want to draw attention to themselves. And here you are in a profession which draws attention to you.
Well, you know, it was kind of cool because I didn't like who I was as this fat kid. But when I was acting, I was playing somebody else. And that person was fat. And, you know, I couldn't help it if that person was fat. And, you know, I was always, you know, under the impression that being fat helped my career, which it may have. But, you know, and I use the excuse of, well, I can't lose weight because it'll ruin my career. I won't be able to get any movie roles anymore. I used that for many, many years to keep the weight on. But it just simply wasn't true. Now, you know, age plays a part in it and the weight loss, but I, you know, am directing now. And I made the transition while I was losing weight to being a director. So it really doesn't matter what I look like when I'm directing.
Now, you were on Babylon 5.
That's when I lost my weight.
That was when you lost the weight. So people could actually see the transition if they watched
right.
that show long enough.
Right, and then you know, science fiction fans are very into the internet, and so there's all these rumors about me being very ill on the internet. Oh, you know, he looks like he's lost a lot of weight. He must have cancer and stuff like that. So I had to dispel those kind of rumors too.
Well, was that ever a concern with because not only just the internet, when anybody loses a large amount of weight, that's unfortunately the first thing a lot of people think of. Was that a concern from the people who might be hiring?
No, people Hollywood's really not that big of a community, and just people knew that I had gone on a diet and lost weight. I mean, the insiders in Hollywood knew this.
How about controlling your diabetes today? How much easier is it, or is it, since you've lost the weight?
It's so much easier. When I was 320 pounds and totally out of control, I was taking 3 shots of insulin a day in my stomach, and now I've been reduced to taking 1 pill a day. I don't take insulin anymore.
Right.
So it certainly helps anyone who's a type 2 diabetic to lose even, you know, 20% of their weight that they need to lose. And I lost 100% of the weight I needed to lose. So,
what do you do in situations when, do you ever feel that, you've lost a lot of weight and there's always a concern that somebody might put it back on. Are there good days and bad days? Do you sometimes let yourself go and still go to the couch with the potatoes, or... is it all behind you now?
You know, it's not that I'm perfect. You know, I don't totally pig out. But there are days like Thanksgiving where I eat a little bit too much and stuff. But, you know, it's become so second nature to me. I changed my lifestyle. I didn't just go on a diet. I had to change my lifestyle. And I don't even think twice about what I eat now.
Now, when you were creating this diet, this idea, did you discuss it with doctors? Did you discuss it with nutritionists? Or did you just go on your own and do this?
You know, I met with a nutritionist one time in the hospital, but everything the nutritionist was telling me was basically common sense. You know, low fat, you know, low carbs, you know, low sugar, that kind of thing. And the thing that I wanted to do was, you know, eat. The key to my success is I never let myself get hungry. Because if I got hungry, that's when I would cheat. So that's basically what my diet's about, is being able to eat tons and tons of food and constantly being full, but, eating the right kinds of food.
You mentioned you're directing. What are you directing these days? And I know you're doing some voice work. What else are you doing?
Yeah, well, voice work. I did Buzz Lightyear and The Star Command and Little Mermaid. And I just finished an acting role in a Stephen King movie called Autopsy Room 4.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm about to direct a film next year called The Jester, kind of a real scary thriller movie.
Now, how long have you been directing?
I've been directing for about 5 years.
Going back to that television show, which I mentioned earlier, of course, St. Elsewhere, which was so much fun. You joined that show while it was already on after the first year. How did you get the role of Dr. Elliot Axelrod?
Well, it's funny because my agent called me and said there's a role on St. Elsewhere. And, she says it's only 5 lines. And I said, well, you know what, I'm not working right now. I'll do it. She goes, no, they want you to audition. I said, they want me to audition for 5 lines? She said, yeah, but it's St. Elsewhere. It's a prestigious show. So I swallowed my pride, and I auditioned for the 5 lines. I got the 5 lines, and they just kept asking me back. And then on the third time they asked me back, they came down and asked me if I wanted to sign a 5-year contract. And, of course, I jumped at the chance because, my gosh, it was wonderful. It was Bruce Paltrow, who actually just passed away.
Right.
Gwyneth Paltrow's dad.
I was going to ask you about Bruce Paltrow, as a matter of fact.
And Gwyneth did a couple of episodes of St. Elsewhere, too.
Mm-hmm. When you got that role, because before that, it was what, 4 years before that, or maybe 5 years before that, Flounder on Animal House?
Yeah, I did Animal House, and then I did a couple of other films that weren't, you know, for Disney that weren't quite as popular. So I was working, but, you know, it was great to get on a regular series, you know.
The role of a doctor was so far from Flounder.
Yeah, he was kind of similar to Flounder, though. He's kind of like he's not sure of himself and you know, bumbling and everything. But they got to let me, you know, I did a lot of comedy, but I got to do some serious stuff, too, which I really, really adored.
Well, that's one of the things is my favorite show I enjoyed the most was that you could literally laugh and cry in the same episode.
Oh, absolutely.
And sometimes maybe even in the same scene. And part of that, of course, I think was the writing.
Well, the writing was so excellent. I mean, we won so many Emmys for the writing, and, you know, and the acting, too. But it was just one of those rare things, and I hope in my lifetime I get to do, you know, something like that again.
What would be your dream role?
My dream role would be to be on a prestigious series like that again as an actor, you know, and that would be it. My dream thing would be to be offered scripts to direct. You know, right now it's like I have to scratch and hunt and do everything I can to get directing jobs, you know, because it's such a fierce competitive business. I would love to be at a point where they'd say, Steve, do you want to direct A, B, or C? Which one? You know, and I could just choose.
When you went on to do, what was it, Babylon 5, that's a whole different world. Well, literally, it's a world where you're on a show that has a cult following. Sci-fi fans are, unlike fans in other shows, they're really rabid. Was that a different situation for you as an actor when you come in contact with fans from that show as opposed to other work you've done?
Yeah, it was a totally different experience. Like you said, sci-fi fans are a breed of their own, and I started to do some of the sci-fi conventions, and the people are just wonderfully, genuinely loving you, but they get very, they act like they know you better than they do, and they want to talk to you for hours, and they're just, they love, you know, details about the episodes and everything. They knew more about the episodes than I did. And I had people come up and do, like, impersonations, and they'd say, guess who I'm doing? I go, I don't know. Who are you doing? They said, I'm doing you. You know, and I'd have to sit there, you know, with a smile on my face, you know. And they'd come dressed up as you and, you know, do, like I said, do impersonations and stuff. But, you know, they just love it. You know, there's all these kind of, like, nerdy people. And it's such a safe haven for them because nobody's going to make fun of them. Whereas in the outside world, if somebody dressed in a Star Trek outfit and kind of acted nerdy, somebody might make fun of them. Now, like in high school. This was a safe haven. They could all act really bizarre and, you know, everything, and nobody's going to make fun of them.
When you get recognized, which do you get recognized for the most? I mean, you've had three very prestigious roles, from Animal House to St. Elsewhere to Babylon 5. What do you get recognized for the most?
Well, you know, now I'm not recognized at all because of the weight loss. When people do talk to me, it's usually about one of those three or another film I did called The Dream Team.
Right.
You know, with Michael Keaton, which I actually shot in Toronto.
Now, I look in the back of your book.
Yes.
And I see something called D4G.
Right. That's a video that I did for American Diabetes. And it's basically guys don't take care of themselves as well as women do.
Right.
And I wanted to make, once again, a funny video where somebody would watch it and laugh. And it's educational, but you don't even know it. So it's basically my life story as told through famous movies like James Bond movies, Austin Powers, Jaws, Psycho. So it's a parody. It's almost like a one-hour Saturday Night Live sketch. All these different movies, takeoffs on the movies.
Now, I see Stuart Pankin is also involved.
Yeah, Stuart Pankin plays me before I lost weight. You know, I play myself as after the losing weight. So, yeah, Stuart was a wonderful character in it. He played all these different characters.
When you see, especially going through as an actor, going through your career as an overweight actor, and sometimes the role calls for that, when you see actors today, some of them very young, who are also very overweight. Does it give you pause to think?
Well, no, not really. I mean, there's going to be overweight people in this world. I mean, 60% of us are carrying too much weight. No, it doesn't. I was just sitting at the table with my family, and there's a book that they're making into a movie, and the lead is somebody who's supposed to be overweight. And I was thinking, I wonder who they're going to get. Who's big enough of a star to carry a movie that's overweight? And we had a hard time because it was originally written, this book was originally written for John Candy, and he's no longer with us. So, you know, we came up with Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Uh-huh.
He isn't anywhere near as heavy as John Candy was, but, you know, he would do a great job in this role.
Stephen, I thank you very, very much for being on the program with us. Continued success, and we hope to see you. I'm looking forward to seeing some of the things you get to direct, but we hope to see you in front of the screen as well, in front of the camera as well as behind it.
Thank you so much. All right, take care.
Actor, director, Stephen Furst. That was a conversation we had back in December of 2002. Stephen passed away on June 16th of this year in California from complications with diabetes. He was 63 years old. Patreon subscribers to the Stuff File program, you can hear the full interview with Stephen Furst as a Patreon reward. Just go to our Patreon page and become one of the selected patrons of the show. Visit patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. And we thank you for your patronage. You're listening to The Stuff File Program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File Program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. This is The Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder. This broadcast is coming to you from upstairs. Get out of the house.
And still to come in the program, we'll talk to the creator of the Hang-O-Matic Plus. Stuart Nolman is in with another edition of Book Banter. We also have an Idiot of the Day coming your way a little later on. And much more Stuff File news right here, right now, on a program that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, the parking garage across from the Metropolitan Correctional Center in Chicago, Illinois, is privately owned, and the Federal Bureau of Prisons, which runs the jail, says it has no authority to remove people from that other property. That includes the women who perform on the garage roof for the benefit of the inmates, often without the benefit of clothing. The shows, one source told the Chicago Sun-Times, are a means for detainees to impress one another. But while the performances have been going on for decades, in the week that the Sun-Times published a story on them, a security guard appeared on the roof. Okay, now I need to know. Is that a real guard or a stripper in a guard costume? Just curious. And Donald Mink of Seymour, Indiana, has been waiting 4 months for the cremated remains of his mother. The North Valley Crematory in Grand Forks, North Dakota, mailed them to him, but the U.S. Postal Service has apparently lost the package. She just passed away so quickly we weren't able to get out there to see her one last time, Minx said. Then I found out I wouldn't be able to lay her to rest. In a statement, the USPS said, "We regret that to date the cremains have not been located, but are committed to our ongoing vigilant search to find them." Meanwhile, a check of the tracking number on the package shows the status as dead mail. Well, that's a fitting title, isn't it? Oh, she's buried all right, somewhere in a huge pile of mail. Meanwhile, employees at a business in Glasgow, West Virginia, call police after a suspicious package was delivered. Investigators say the package contained 3 pounds of methamphetamines worth several hundred thousand dollars. A search found more drugs and a gun in a company car. The employee of Kanawha Valley Memorial Garden Cemetery using that car, Terry Richards, was arrested. 3 pounds of meth. That's enough to, you know, wake the dead. Good thing he worked at a cemetery. Anyway, as Americans struggle politically with the battle for health care, let's share a story from the UK about animals and their health. In April, the annual report of the Association of British Insurers on its members' policies for pet owners noted that among the claims paid were those for a bearded dragon with an abscess, an anorexic Burmese python, a cocker spaniel that swallowed a turkey baster, a cockatoo with respiratory problems, and even a lethargic house cat, which nonetheless cost the equivalent of about $470 to treat. Wow, animals with better health care than millions of people. Just think about that for a moment. Think about that. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, In March, Zimbabwean pastor Paul Sanyangor of Victory World International Ministries was captured on video during a sermon telephoning God. Clutching a phone to his ear, he yelled, "Hello, is this heaven? I have a woman here. What do you have to say to her?" Her two children, one epileptic and the other asthmatic, were then confusingly described by heaven as being changed, and Paul ended the call to resounding cheers from the congregation. Are you telling me that someone can call heaven and not go through, at the very least, phone menu purgatory, if not full-blown voicemail hell?
Hello. Thank you for calling heaven. We're sorry all of our angels are busy helping other sinners right now. However, your prayer is important to us and will be answered in the order it was received. So please, stay on the line. Also, be advised that our menu has changed. If you're looking to reach the big guy, press 1 now. If his son will do, press 2 now. If your sports team needs help this weekend, press 3 now. If your sports team is either the New York Jets or the Toronto Maple Leafs, just hang up. If you're a religious icon who preys on gullible beings, clinging to any kind of hope for a dire situation, please press 666 now.
Let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Jared Rabin, along with his wife Karina, are the creators of a product that makes life easier for anyone who has ever wanted to hang pictures in their home. It's called the Hang-O-Matic. It measures, levels, and marks your walls for hanging wall decor like a professional. Jared joins us on the line right now from California to talk a bit about the product and the journey it has taken them on. Hi, Jared.
Hi, how you doing? Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on the program with us. Now, I understand, I actually saw you because you just recently, you were on an episode of Thunderdome on ABC, and I understand this is something you've been working on since you were in college, is that correct?
That is right, since I was, I think, 19 years old in sophomore year in college.
Now, is this one of those situations where necessity is the mother of invention and also finding a way to build a better mousetrap? In other words, were you trying to hang pictures when you realized there's got to be an easier way?
Exactly. I was actually trying to hang pictures in an off-campus housing, and I was trying to not get back charged by destroying my wall. So the more holes you put in your wall, the more the apartment complex back charges you to do the repairs. So it was out of necessity when I was trying to hang stuff.
And how long has the process been for you from the idea, the genesis of this, the creation of it, to the point where you actually got it into stores?
15 years, believe it or not. I spent several years prototyping it by hand and just being able to afford the patents and the engineering and getting manufacturing in line. But about 15 years total from the time I thought of it to the time I got into the first retail location.
And by the way, what is your educational background? You said you were in university, but what were you taking? Were you an engineering student, or was this something else entirely different from what you were going to school for?
I was a psychology major with the intent of getting my law degree. And it was nothing to do with what I had ever imagined, but my background is my dad owned a tool store, and so did my grandpa. So I've been around like tools my entire life, so I've been very... I guess blessed with the ability to, be handy and put things together. So that's kind of like where I went from, a pre-law dream to building a tool.
When I saw you on the show the other day, and this was the premiere episode of Thunderdome, the first thing that came to my mind was, have you tried before Thunderdome to get on shows like Shark Tank?
We got on Thunderdome by trying out for Shark Tank. So Karina and I, my wife and I, were at our fourth round of Shark Tank tryouts, where they basically called us back and said, "Hey, we're not getting you on Shark Tank, but Mark Burnett has another show that's new called Thunderdome. Are you interested in that one instead?" And we said, "Sure, heck yeah!" So we were intending to go on Shark Tank, and we instead landed ourselves on the Steve Harvey Thunderdome.
With your appearance on Thunderdome, has there been any positive fallout from that experience now that it's aired? As a matter of fact, it's aired twice. It aired on the weekend, and then it was repeated on Wednesday. Did that help in publicizing your product?
I mean, in the short term, it's been less than a week. In the short term, it's obviously really helped our online sales, not only on our website, but our partners, our retailers' websites. A lot of publicity, a lot of people reaching out and wanting to connect with us from a funding standpoint and a partnership standpoint. It's too early to see. I'm hoping it'll make the brand recognizable for the brick and mortar stores who are stocking Hang-O-Matic, like Bed Bath Beyond. Someone walks in there and now sees the brand and goes, "Oh, that's that tool I saw." But so far, it's been interesting, and sales are up, and weirdo emails are up too, of course. But kind of early to say.
We should mention the website, by the way. People can check out hangomatic.com if they want to order one, correct?
Correct. HANGOMATIC.com. Already Bed Bath Beyond stores stocks them in actual brick and mortar stores.
Now, in addition to creating this, and I hope it becomes an amazing success, because I saw it on television, like I said, and I thought, wow, that is something. I recently put up pictures here in my home recently, and I thought of all the things I needed to do that, and you made it seem so easy. So I can't imagine that this won't be a great success. Having said that, you're also giving back, are you not?
We are. We donate 10% of our proceeds to the George Lopez Foundation, which is goes for kidney research. My wife, unfortunately, was born with a kidney disease. So we like to think that, the more successful we are, the more we give back right away. The more we'll be blessed with success and hopefully a cure for, kidney disease, which is what my wife was afflicted with.
How did you get in contact with the George Lopez Foundation?
It was actually, we were trying to do it on our own. We were trying to raise money for kidney research on our own. And my wife, who is the, believe it or not, the talker in the relationship, connected with someone who was connected with the, a manager of George Lopez. So I said to her, why don't you see if, because we weren't having a lot of success getting attention and trying to generate more revenue for the donation. So I asked my wife to try and connect, and she did, and it's helped a lot getting awareness and getting a little more firepower behind the message, which is hey, we're just starting out and we're giving back already, and help us give back and pay attention to us. So.
Well, it's an amazing journey you and your wife are on, especially with this product. Now that it's out, how has it changed the trajectory of your life? You said you were going to college and what you were taking when you were there. That's not the route you took. How has this changed your life?
Well, so a couple years ago, my wife and I started getting orders, significant orders. And we had a decision to make: do we take on a partner or sell our home? So we had our dream home in Orange County, California. We sold our house and moved east about an hour. So we had some cash to not take on a partner and keep paying them out for ourselves. So right now, these sales are helpful getting us out of debt, because we had to borrow somewhere up to $500,000 to get where we are today. So right now, in terms of trajectory, it's just a matter of us paying back those who were gracious enough to give us money. We have a line of credit with the bank. We sold the house. I pushed my parents' money. So I would say, if anything, I'm now happy and complacent with doing Hang-O-Matic for a living. But it's also nice that now we're able to start paying back some of the debt that we accrued, over almost a decade of research and development, prototyping, and those type of things.
One of the great things about the American spirit is the entrepreneurial spirit. And in this day and age, having gone through what you went through, what do you say to others who have a dream that they're thinking about fulfilling but are concerned about the bumps in the road along the way?
So that's a great question. So I still work full time. So I still have my 9-to-5. I do Hang-O-Matic before work and after work, and my wife does it pretty much full time when I'm at work. I would say, you know, go for your dream, go for it. But if you can hold on to your day job or your revenue stream and have the, you know, the ability to multitask for a while and not risk, you know, I have two children, so to not risk, you know, losing it all, you know, go for it. And I was blessed with enough energy where I could work, you know, 14 hours a day and I could do both. And I kept that day job as a backup plan just in case. I was never comfortable putting it all on the line and saying, I'm just going to go ahead and go back 100%. I'm just working twice as many hours, unfortunately. So I say go for it. But if you can have a little bit of a cushion, backup plan already in place, it'll give you the longevity to do your product longer without being strapped for cash and making like foolish or rushed decisions.
And what is your day job?
I manage a construction supply company. So I have about 38 employees and I send tools to job sites all over California.
Wow. And you also have two small children, right?
I do have a 1-year-old and a 4-year-old boy.
Wow. So you're living the dream and taking the chance all at the same time.
Oh, yeah. Luckily, my wife, it sounds crazy, but more than ever, my wife and I have to eat healthy and exercise to keep up with these two little kids and the two businesses. It's been a draining, to say the least.
Well, continued success. Again, people can find out more information by going to your website, which is hangomatic.com. People in the United States can find it on retail store shelves like Bed Bath & Beyond, Home Depot, Ace Hardware, Lowe's, and several other places. I guess you could also find it on Amazon.com. So it's getting out there. Congratulations on fulfilling your dream and following through with it. And thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate the time.
Jared Rabin, creator of the Hangomatic. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0410, and you'll find links to Jared's site. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holden.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. For many teenagers, mowing lawns during the summer will be their first job. For parents, it's a great way to get older kids outside, on a schedule, and earning money. And if they live in certain areas, it can be a good lesson in how government bureaucracy works too. Wait, what? Here's the story. Earlier this spring, a city in Alabama said it was going to require teenagers to get a professional license to cut grass. The license costs $110, and apparently an adult with a lawn cutting business demanded that teens get licensed too. As you might expect, the city took a lot of criticism for making it harder for teens to find work, and eventually it did the right thing by backing off and granting a waiver for full-time students. Let's be fair. Occupational licensing can be a way to protect the public from unqualified professionals. Yet it's gotten out of control in some communities, and when that happens, it can not only hurt kids, but adults, too. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamericatv.org.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And coming in for the checkered flag, we do indeed have Stuart Nauman. Hello, Stu.
Hello, Peter. We're going to talk about this edition of Book Banter, a book about the man who did not direct 12 Years a Slave.
Oh, you mean it's not that Steve McQueen?
No, it's the other Steve McQueen.
Oh, gosh darn, I was getting all excited.
No, this is the one who gave us Bullet and The Blob and Magnificent Seven and Great Escape. But
are you really, after all of the stuff he's done in the latter part of his career that he was known for, are you really going to still pin the Blob on him? Really?
Well, I could have said Wanted, Dead or Alive.
Can't you let that one go?
Well, it's a cult classic now.
Okay. I'm sure he spent his entire career trying to outlive the Blob.
I know, but, it'll always stick to him, so to speak. But yes, well, this edition of Book Banter, yes, we're going to talk about Steve McQueen, the late, great Steve McQueen, and one aspect of his passions, which is auto racing, and his career movies. Because in the world of sports, movies are, at best, a mere handful of memorable movies dealing with the fast-paced, highly dangerous world of auto racing, and only three come to mind for me. One is Grand Prix with James Gardner. The other one is Rush, Ron Howard's speed-charged story of the James Hunt, Niki Lauda F1 rivalry during the 70s, which is a terrific movie. And Le Mans, Steve McQueen's docudrama tribute to the endurance test that is 24 hours of Le Mans, the end of the race in France. And it's the latter movie that is the subject of a fascinating pictorial behind-the-scenes coffee table book that tells the story of the making of Le Mans and how it toppled one of the most popular male movie stars of the 60s. It's called Steve McQueen, Le Mans in the Rearview Mirror. It's written by Hollywood veteran prop man Don Nunley, who served as the movie's property master, and it chronicles through his words and pictures, there are over 400 of them in color and black and white, of how this troubled-plagued racing movie, to end all racing movies, was agonizingly put together throughout the summer of 1970. Now, McQueen was a self-confessed speed junkie who loved to race motorcycles and cars, and he wanted to make the ultimate auto racing movie as his personal pet project. And he wanted to focus on the F1 circuit until Grand Prix quashed those plans in 1966. And as a result, he then set his sights on the 24 hours of Le Mans. Now, through Nunley's words and pictures, he effectively tells the story of how Le Mans was a troubled production from the moment the camera started rolling. The production went for weeks without a finished script. The shooting went for weeks over schedule and $1 million over budget, which back in 1970 was quite a chunk of change. And most of all, the production had to deal with McQueen's massive ego and sometimes childish behavior, which began when the insurance company for the movie wouldn't allow him to participate in the actual Le Mans race. You know, God forbid he gets into an accident and he gets injured or killed, you know, there goes the movie, right?
Right.
Right. So, however, Nunley does share a great deal of interesting anecdotes about the production that helped to balance the ill feelings amongst the cast and crew that eventually festered throughout the shoot. One of my favorites was there was a time that there was a basketball game that Nunley organized at his chateau. He stayed at a very nice chateau in France during the shooting of Le Mans during one weekend between the Le Mans crew and a group of local French players. However, the crew didn't realize until it was only too late that they were about to face off against the championship French national basketball team. So I guess it was sort of a one-sided contest.
Yeah, but when you say championship national, a French national basketball team, that's like saying Ecuador's second finest playwright, really. You think about it.
Yeah, that's true. But yeah. Still,
I mean, they're probably just one step above the you know, the Washington Generals.
Hey, but they were a team of professionals.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. So, released in 1971 in the summer, a year after the movie was made, Le Mans was a critical and commercial flop. However, time has been quite kind to Le Mans and has gradually found an audience and cult status as one of the definitive, honest movies about the world of auto racing. And the book Steve McQueen, Le Mans in the Rearview Mirror, is an adrenaline-charged portrait of a movie star's pet project that went totally awry, which left many car wrecks in its wake, and yet has now become a sports movie classic, not to mention retained the superstar status of Hollywood's original Macho Man.
We had Don Nunley on the program a couple of months ago, and he's a fascinating guest talking about his book, obviously, and his recollections of Steve and working on that movie. And the fact that he was also a very young props manager, certainly young for someone to be a props manager when he did that movie.
Yeah, and he got a lot done. He pulled a lot of strings and, you know, pulled a lot of rabbits out of his hat to get a lot of important props. Even managed to get Tag Heuer, the expensive watch company, to have McQueen wear one of the watches as sort of like product placement. And one of those watches, Nunley still has, and it's worth a lot of money.
I think one of the things with Nunley is he got a lot of things done because it was the bulldoggedness of inexperience, even though he comes from a family of people who've done this job for a living. But it's a situation of, if he knew how difficult the job would have been, he might have been more daunted by the prospect of what he was doing.
Yeah, true. And I guess his youth was sort of like I say, he was seeing things through rose-colored glasses, getting a chance to work on a major production with a superstar.
Exactly, exactly. Anyway, the book is entitled?
Steve McQueen, Le Mans in the Rearview Mirror. It's by Don Nunley and Marshall Terrill. Published by Dalton Watson Fine Books, a quality coffee table book publisher. And it's $79.
And in the same genre, what do you recommend, sir?
Well, I recommend one of the first biographies I've ever read about Steve McQueen by his friend William F. Nolan. It was published in 1986. It's called Plainly McQueen. And it's one of the first books to explore many aspects of Steve McQueen, not only the actor and superstar, but the man himself and his complexities and also his passions for motorcycle racing, auto racing. It's one of the first true detailed studies about Steve McQueen and the man and the actor. And auto racing, not that many books around, but one that I reviewed when I was with the Suburban newspaper back in 1989 is called, it's about Gilles Villeneuve. It's called Gilles Villeneuve, The Life of the Legendary Racing Driver. And it's by a well-known F-car racing journalist named Gerald Donaldson. And I read it. It's probably, it's a terrific book, and it's been lauded as one of the best biographies of a racing car driver ever, and gives a real human touch to this championship F1 driver who left us way too soon.
I'm just glad you didn't bring up an Ally McGraw book.
Oh, no. That's off limits.
So this week's book, again, is?
It's called Steve McQueen, Le Mans in the Rearview Mirror by Don Lendley with Marshall Terrill, and it's published by Dalton Watson Fine Books, and it's $79. And when he was doing Le Mans, that was before Ally McGraw. He was still married to his wife, Neil, just
yes.
Before, you know.
Thank you. And if you want to find you, how can they do so, sir?
Well, not at Circuit Gilles Villeneuve or at Le Mans, France, for those races. You're going to find me in the pages of the Montreal Times, in print, every Saturday, or online at www.mtltimes.ca.
Thank you very much, Stu.
Welcome, and...
Stuart Nelman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're into the home stretch here on this edition of the Stuff File program. We do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on, but I got a few more Stuff File news stories that I would like to share with you here on a program that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this an even bigger and better radio experience. Yes, and we're also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, by the way, the smarter way to listen to radio. And various other places. We're everywhere. We're omnipotent. Anyway, let's get back to the stuff, shall we? Police in Central Texas say a woman fell into a foul mood when a fast food restaurant took too long in delivering her chicken nuggets, and she called 911 from the drive-thru lane to complain. Waco Police Sergeant W. Patrick Swanton said the woman wanted the nuggets given to her for free because of the delay. Swanton says the woman was parked in the drive-thru lane at McDonald's, refusing to budge and being confrontational with employees as vehicles lined up behind her. A restaurant employee called 911 to have police move the woman along, and officers were responding when the woman also made her own call to 911 to complain. The unidentified woman was given her money back and told to leave without her nuggets. You know, I don't mind a little wait for my nuggets at the drive-thru, especially at night, which is when this story took place. That's much better than when you get your nuggets a little too fast. That usually means they've been sitting around for a while and they are often the consistency of a Super Bowl. Yeah. Anyway, we have three separate stories that we're packing together that all deal with the things that people collect. And the headline for all three could simply be one word: inexplicable. Story number one. It recently became necessary for Candice Frazee and Steve Lubansky to acquire a bigger house in the Los Angeles area because their 33,000 bunny-related items, like stuffed bunnies, antique bunnies, bunny paintings, bunny dinnerware, etc., 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 needed more space. Yeah. Number two, the world's only museum devoted to the House Cat allows self-guided tours in Silva, North Carolina, where curator Harold Sims displays 10,000 artifacts, including a genuine petrified cat with whiskers pulled from a 16th century English chimney. Yeah. And finally, number three, Brantford, Ontario, real estate agent Kyle Jansink, speaking for Unidentified Sellers, said he accepted the challenge of selling the meticulously maintained home as is, still packed with the seller's clown-related items: dolls, miniatures, porcelain statues, paintings, the list goes on and on and on. Again, all three stories are inexplicable, and all three stories are creepy in their very own way. Anyway, we have come to the end of the program, boys and girls, and as you know, at this juncture of the show, it's the moment you've all been waiting for. Yes, it's time once again for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. This stuff all presents the Idiot of the Day.
Police didn't have to go far to bust a group of suspected heroin dealers. They lived right next door to the station. Detectives were on their way to execute a search warrant on an apartment in the Laurel Gardens public housing complex, one door north of the station on Main Street in Danbury, Connecticut, when they realized that one of the suspects was conducting business in his car just outside. 24-year-old Denzel Wilkins, who had been under investigation for weeks, was nabbed in the act of selling to a customer. He was arrested along with his customer, 25-year-old Marissa Palumbo. Investigators then ran to Wilkins' apartment, where they found another resident, 25-year-old Tiffany Ortiz, with a young child. A search of the apartment uncovered additional heroin packaged for sale and an undisclosed amount of cash. Both Wilkins and Palumbo were found with heroin packaged for sale, according to police. Palumbo was charged with possession of narcotics and released on the promise to appear in court. Wilkins and Ortiz face a string of charges, including possession of narcotics with the intent to sell and risk of injury to a minor. Now, why? Oh, why? If you're a drug dealer, would you not only set up shop next door to a police station, but also conduct business right outside both your doors? Well, one reason, and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0410. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number. And once again, that's 0410. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder. And don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. I'm your announcer, your name here. Oh, I'm sorry. This is Ben Patrick Johnson. What am I being paid for this? What? You're flipping kidding me. Okay, that's it. Turn off the microphone.